Next week on Interval, Francis will be featuring some of the out-of-print recordings of trumpeter Bill Dixon. Tomorrow morning at 9:06, WUHY will be providing live coverage of hearings that will be held in Washington by the President's Commission on the accident at Three Mile Island. On Wednesday of this week, an engineer for Babcock & Wilcox, the company that designed the crippled Three Mile Island nuclear reactor, told the commission that he warned in 1977 against interference with the automatic emergency cooling systems. Joseph Kelly told the Presidential Commission that he urged the company to issue a warning to all users of plants of that type. Documents obtained by the commission show that such a warning was issued, but it was issued after the Three Mile Island accident, and Kelly says operators at Three Mile Island did not follow the procedures that he outlined. So tomorrow at 10:06 in the morning, WUHY will provide live coverage of hearings before the Presidential Commission. At that time, testimony will be heard from Donald Ray, Manager of Engineering for Babcock & Wilcox, and John McMillan, Vice President of Nuclear Power Generation for Babcock & Wilcox. They're expected to either refute the earlier charges or to admit to knowledge of alleged serious design flaws. So that's coming up tomorrow at 10:06 here on WUHY, and we expect at this point that the hearings will be approximately 4 hours. At this point, we're expecting Fresh Air will start at its regular time, 2 o'clock. This is Fresh Air, and you're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. It's now 1 minute after 4 o'clock. When you're fat, what are some of the assumptions that people have of you? In Pennsylvania, a woman was refused a position in a large company because she's overweight, although she passed all the other skill tests. The Human Relations Commission is pursuing this on the basis of the Pennsylvania Human Relations Act. In Wisconsin, a couple was denied the right to adopt a child on the basis of their being overweight. Recently in Maryland, Governor Harry Hughes signed a bill allowing for a 5-year study of size discrimination in the state. For the next hour on Fresh Air, we're going to discuss the problems of discrimination faced by fat people and the stereotypes surrounding fat people and the medical problems that they face. Joining us on the phone in a few minutes will be one of the most radical people within what is now called the Fat Liberation Movement, Vivian Mayer. Now, she thinks that the medical problems associated with being fat have been greatly exaggerated. She thinks that dieting is usually a frustrating experience that doesn't work. The biggest problems faced by fat people, according to Vivian Mayer, are the discrimination that they face and the stigma of being overweight. After we hear from her, we'll speak with Dr. Carolyn Michelson, who is a founder of Associates in Medical Nutrition and Weight Control. She has worked with many fat clients and has created and organized diet plans for them. Before we speak with Dr. Carolyn Michelson and with Vivian Mayer, who will both be joining us on the telephone, I'd like to introduce to you my two guests in the studio. With me is Edie Callahan, who's the president of the Southeast Pennsylvania chapter of NAFA. NAFA stands for the National Association to Aid Fat Americans. She is also a member of the MARPL Planning Commission. Edie Callahan is, I should mention, fat. With me also is Natalie Allen, who's a sociologist who has studied and written about the self-perceptions of overweight people, and she's also studied group approaches to dieting. She is concerned about discrimination against fat people. She has worked as a non-paid advisor to NAFA. She is not herself fat. She's also an assistant professor of sociology at the Philadelphia College of Textiles and Sciences. By the way, later in our conversation, our phone lines will be open for your questions and comments. When the phone lines are open, I'll give the telephone number. Natalie Allen, Edie Callahan, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. Hello.
Edie, I'd like to ask you what NAFA is to you.
Well, I think in NAFA's brochure, they explain that NAFA is a nonprofit organization that to increase the happiness and well-being of overweight Americans, and also that fat people have trouble merely being treated like human beings. And I think NAFA makes us all feel like, and has tried to make us feel like, we're part of the human race and not something different. And that has been NAFA's goals. NAFA is not concerned with dieting. That's up to individuals, how they feel, individual fat people feel about that. But NAFA has tried to make us feel and make people in the country know, people that aren't fat, that we are also individuals. Just because we're fat doesn't mean we're something different in this world. We're people. We're just regular people. And that's also my philosophy, that people are people, regardless of what their size is.
Did joining NAFA change your opinions of yourself and your own self-image, Edie?
Not of myself. I don't have any hang-ups to a degree, but it changed my outlook toward a lot of people. I mean, I'm like anybody else. When I see someone that's bigger than I am, my mind starts clicking just like everybody else does, or someone that's different. But it changed my outlook on a lot of things, and it made me see people who were treated so unfairly because they were fat, and to understand their problems and their social problems, which I myself have never had, but to understand that people had these terrible problems. And now I can, relate to them better.
Natalie Allen, let me ask you, why, as a sociologist, you have done numerous studies about fat people?
I was about 30 pounds more than I am now when I was in high school. I was technically called by some people chubby. And I felt very self-conscious, felt stigmatized, felt people were sometimes snickering at me. I wasn't that fat in absolute pounds that you might talk about, but I always remembered some of the pain and anguish as an adolescent that I felt, and had that tucked away in the back of my mind, even though later on I did lose some weight, although my weight went up and down. I've also intellectually been very much interested in group efforts to help people in terms of social support. And when I started some of my research in the latter 60s, group dieting had not been systematically studied that much other than anecdotal impressionistic kind of evidence. So with my personal interest and my professional interest in groups, I felt that there should be some research done on group dieting efforts.
You have also studied the self-image that many fat people have of themselves. Can you summarize for us some of the things that you found?
Yes, I think that some fat people, children, adolescents, and adults, are very self-conscious of their weight. They feel that their weight is an exclusive focus for other people to relate to them, that the world is looking at them in terms of their body weight as a central focus. People can hardly see anything about them except they're overweight. Also, some fat people feel a very bad negative body image. They feel that they are like elephants or hippopotamuses. Sometimes they laugh about it, but behind the laughter are tears. Other fat people do not experience such negative body images, and this coming out in other studies beside my own. Some people who are fat feel that their fat is people don't know how to respond to them. They sort of want to show them pity, but they also feel repugnant to the fat people. What's wrong with you, you bad person? You should be ashamed of yourself for being a pig and a glutton, when very many fat people do not so much overeat. And then that the other people also feel that they have to act nice to the fat person. One quote from some of my research, the putting the foot in the mouth of one girl, an adolescent fat person, said that a young man hoped that it was not too much trouble for her to get into the back seat of his car, as one example of not putting his foot in his mouth. Also, overweight is viewed as clashing with other good traits of the person, positive traits, so to speak. Again, some other quotes on this: you are so fortunate to have such a beautiful face, even though you are a little heavy. Or for a big girl, you are so well coordinated, graceful, and quick on your feet. Again, the notion of, well, should you invite the fat person out socially? Should you encourage them to eat if you're going out for dinner? They should be on a diet, perhaps, or if they're not, you better tell them that they should be on a diet, or you're going to make them go off their diet if they are out socially. And what you have really going on in self-image is, well, many things, but two of which are that some fat people feel that they are sick, they're ill, they're not responsible for their condition, and other fat people feel that they're almost like criminals, that they should be punished for their fat, that it is their fault, and they really feel that there's almost something wrong with them, and they want sometimes even punitive treatment to try to scare or get the weight off them. So there's sometimes an illness factor, and there is sometimes people feel that it is their fault, so this whole business of the responsibility issue is central in self-image, how people feel responsible for their fatness or do not feel so responsible for their fatness.
Okay, can you just tell me briefly what you mean by fat? Are we talking about someone who's put on a few pounds on the recent vacation? Are we talking about someone who is a little larger than the standard size weight charts? Or are we talking about something different?
Socially, I would say that sometimes the words fat, overweight, obesity can be used interchangeably because there is no hard and fast clear-cut definition by physical scientists and by medical doctors on what we mean by fat, overweight, obese, whatever, although there have been suggested kinds of definitions. My own research, for example, showed that when I was about 30 pounds heavier and I went to group dieting clubs, when I went to some working-class Italian and Irish clubs, people wanted to fatten me up. They wanted me to gain weight. They thought I was too skinny. What was I doing there to do the study? I didn't understand it. Some of these women felt they were happy to get into a size 20, whereas when I went to some upper-middle-class Jewish group dieting plans, people looked me up and down and said, what are you doing studying us? Don't you think you should really be on the diet? And some of these people felt very upset that they couldn't squeeze into their size 5. And so that it's very much of a relative phenomena. Who are you comparing what to what in terms of who is fat compared to who is, so to speak, skinny? Very hard definitionally.
Okay, well, with this, I'd like to connect to Vivian Mayer, who will be speaking with us in a moment from New Haven, Connecticut. Vivian Mayer is probably one of the most radical people within the fat liberation movement. She is the manager of Fat Liberator Publications, which publishes pamphlets about fat liberation. Now, she's also organized fat women's groups, the Fat Women Underground in Los Angeles, and in New Haven, she organized a fat women's group through the New Haven Women's Center. Hi, Vivian. We're on the air now.
Hello.
You have said that fat people face more political problems than medical problems. Can you explain what you mean?
Sure. I think that the basic social problems that fat people have in terms of negative attitudes against them are well known to most people. I mean, most people are aware that fat people suffer negative stereotypes, etc. But I think that I can give you an example of how this is a political problem rather than a medical problem by giving a specific example. What I was thinking of was the question of, say, job discrimination. I think that if people have been looking in the papers in the last couple of months, they've noticed that here and there they hear about cases where people are denied employment because of their weight. And let's say, you know, take a typical case like this. It's gone on for quite a while, quite a few years, and most of the time you don't hear about it because, as a rule, when the fat person is denied employment, the reaction is, first of all, to be stunned, you know, and secondly, to just feel very guilty and feel, well, you know, it's my fault, and if anything, to try to use the experience as a way of motivating oneself to try harder to lose weight. But let's say you have a fat person who decides that she has, in fact, been discriminated against, and she wants to go to court to fight for her right to have this job. Well, she may go to court assuming that she's got a political problem of discrimination. But what frequently happens when she gets to court is that the way the courts look at it is that she is not really a victim of discrimination, or that the discrimination that she's complaining about is not real discrimination. What they look at are primarily the question that, first of all, it's assumed that if you're fat and you have this minority status, which causes you these difficulties, unlike other minorities, fat people presumably can lose this minority status by just, you know, going on a diet and losing weight, and that presumably entails eating reasonably. And another issue that would interest the courts would be the question of, you know, is this person really at fault for being fat? Can she claim that she's handicapped in some way, that this is a physical handicap, or, in fact, is it just, as one public health official in Los Angeles told me, is it just a problem for not pushing herself away from the table soon enough? And so a very subtle thing has happened, or maybe it's not so subtle, but the point is that when you go in quite feeling that this is a obvious political problem, I mean job discrimination, the way the court finally sees it is as a medical problem. Should you lose weight? And what they do then is they will bring in a medical authority to decide on whether or not you should lose weight, rather than take up the legal question of whether or not you have been denied a job for which you're qualified. Now, that in itself is a political problem, because what happens is that the medical profession now has the power to abridge fat people's civil rights. The medical profession, because it is seen as being linked with science, and doctors are supposedly very well informed about all these objective pieces of information, the experiments on obesity and so on, it tends to be seen as, you know, this is the absolute fact, and you can't argue it. And, of course, the fat person then loses the case and will go home and try to diet or be very bitter, et cetera, whatever happens with this individual. Now, the medical authority itself brings up another question of, is this authority legitimate? And when you think of what the authority is based on, it's based on the idea that these people have some knowledge that is factual, that is objective, that is beyond what the layperson would have.
Well, Vivian, let me ask you, you have made a strong case about the political discrimination that fat people face, but what about the medical problems? Are you saying that fat people shouldn't try to diet? Are you saying that there aren't serious medical problems that a person who is fat will face?
Well, I think that the problem is, again, let's look at what the stereotypic view of a fat person is that this is a person who's fat because she stuffs herself with food, and she stuffs herself with food either because she's too ignorant to know what good nutrition is or because she's neurotic and trying to compensate for all these psychological problems, and that this person could lose weight through reasonable effort, and that her being fat because of all this bad nutrition causes problems to her health. That's the standard view, and that's what the doctors will pretty much say in their authority over fat people. Now, as a matter of fact, when you actually look in the researches to see what is known through these studies about fat people, one of the first things that leaps out at you is that being fat is not a reversible condition for most people. The failure rate of reducing diets is in the neighborhood of 98% to 99%. And a particular study that I quote a lot on that was a statement by Alvin Feinstein, who's a professor of medicine at Yale University. And he pointed this out when he was addressing a group of doctors on the subject of diet drugs and so on in a 1972 conference on that. And what he did was he looked through all the literature to find the best documented reports of success of reducing diets. And he ruled out all those reports that simply did a short-term follow-up, like, you know, a month after the diet started, such and such a percentage had lost weight, because he figured the real important thing is, can you keep the weight off? And, in fact, he criticized a lot of reducing programs and a lot of doctors for, in general, stating that their diet works or that they have a successful program, when, in fact, they, number one, they do not do long-term follow-up, and number two, they just drop from their statistics all those people who left the diet because they weren't losing weight on it or they couldn't stand the diet, you know. So he really questions whether this is valid, and what he came up with was this conclusion that reducing diets have a failure rate of 98% to 99%.
Vivian, do you think that fat people should not diet, or are you saying that fat people who have a history of weight gain after the weight loss should maybe give up on dieting?
Well, I think that, first of all, I would say that repeated dieting is probably one of the chief health hazards that fat people face. Given the really high failure rate, any fat person with, you know, who wants to fit in with society, which is most of us, will keep on trying to lose weight over and over again. And this repeated dieting has been really clearly linked with heart disease, and also arguments could link it with kidney problems, diabetes, and so on. And I really question, again, what goes on when a fat person goes to a doctor and the doctor says, you've got to lose the weight, you know, for your health, and proceeds to prescribe a cure which has a failure rate of 98% to 99%, and in fact will increase the risk of the very diseases that it's supposed to help you avoid.
Vivian, what do you recommend to fat people who you know, and what kind of course of action have you taken?
Well, I think that it's a real problem because you're talking about people who are so desperate and so beaten down with guilt that to contemplate the thought of not constantly trying to lose weight is, you know, like the worst thing that they could imagine. What I would recommend is that when a fat person is contemplating a diet, ask what is the permanent success rate of the diet. And, you know, of course, you know, ask, has it been followed up for years? You know, how many of the people who started it have been able to stay on it? Because even the problem is that fat people are not, don't want to hear the answer, as a rule. The answer is, for any one of these diets, that the permanent success rate is extremely small. That is a message of despair, given the present social conditions. And short of the sort of pioneering work that's being done right now in the fat liberation movement, where fat people are forming groups for mutual support to help deal with the personal implications of what it means to have this really almost horribly futile struggle ahead of you, I don't really know what the answer is, other than that people should get information. I mean, I know for myself what the answer is, but I can't prescribe this for other people because I'm aware of the level of suffering that fat people go through.
Well, Vivian, we're out of time now. I want to thank you very much for joining us on the telephone, and I hope we could talk more in depth sometime.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Vivian Mayer spoke with us from her home in New Haven. She is the manager of Fat Liberator Publications, which is based in New Haven. I've asked Dr. Carolyn Michelson, who specializes in nutrition in her practice, to respond to Vivian's comments. Dr. Michelson is the founder of Associates in Medical Nutrition and Weight Control, which is a medically supervised program. She works with overweight and underweight clients, as well as with people who have deficiency diseases. Carolyn Michelson is also the editor of The Medical Reader, a medical journal for professional and lay people. Dr. Michelson, hi, we're on the air.
Hello.
You heard Vivian, and she was talking about how weight seems to be more of a political problem than a medical problem. She was very critical of many people in the medical profession and of the way they treat fat people. How would you respond to her comments?
Well, I think, first of all, I'm very sympathetic to a lot of the things that Vivian said, and I kind of like to make a statement to clarify my political position on the matter. I am a champion of feminism and of individual human rights. I'm also a medical doctor. This means that I am concerned about the welfare of people and specifically concerned about the physical and spiritual well-being of people. But having said that, I'm still a defender of people's right to choose how they live and the condition of their own bodies. If people choose to drink or smoke to excess, I have no right to challenge their basic right to do so. If people choose to be homosexual, for instance, even in this society in which this lifestyle is met with scorn and discrimination, I have no argument. If people wish to be fat, I have no argument. However, I do feel that as a physician, I have a duty to inform people of the health risks of certain lifestyles, including the risks of being overweight. People who are overweight by just 20 pounds run a greater risk of developing diabetes, hypertension, arteriosclerotic cardiovascular disease, stroke, and heart attack. Also, as a physician, I'm obliged to help people who choose to be treated medically for alcoholism, smoking, homosexuality, and obesity. In fact, I'm especially interested in helping people who are overweight because we can now offer new techniques which have a profound effect on our success rate. And we are able to help people lose weight and keep it off. And by the way, it does not matter whether the obesity problem has its roots in politics, genetics, biochemistry, or psychology. The same techniques seem to work for everyone.
Well, Vivian was saying that according to the figures she knows, there's only a 1 to 2% effectiveness in dieting, and 98 to 99% of diets seem to be ineffective, and that the person who has lost the weight puts it on in a matter of time again. You think that that's no longer true?
Well, I'd say that I have to use my own experience. I'm now collecting my data, so I cannot give you hard figures. There's a certain percentage of people who enter our program who find that it's not right for them and they leave. I would say, if I had to guess, that would be about 10% of people will leave right away. Of the other people, I would say that we have about a 70 to 80% success rate. And what I mean by that is people who come and who work at it and who probably will stick with us for maybe 1, 2, or even 3 years,
possibly even longer, because the way we look at the problem of obesity is the way we look at the problem of high blood pressure, diabetes, and other chronic problems, and that is it's a problem which will be with a person for the rest of their lives, and they have to come and see us for a long, long time before they can control it, and in some cases, they may need support and help for the rest of their lives.
There are many people who have a history of diet, weight loss, and then over a period of time, weight gain. I think NAFA states in their policy statement that it's sometimes more harmful for someone to go through this constant cycle of weight loss, weight gain, weight loss, weight gain, than to remain at a constant weight, even if that weight is large by our standards. How would you react to that?
I would say that's probably very true. I think it's a disaster psychologically and physically to constantly be going up and down. And I think that's one of the things that I have been striving to change in my work with obese people. That is, I've been trying to find a method which will keep people from going through this up and down cycle. It's there psychologically because of the despair that people, the despair and depression that can result. It's also bad physically because every time you lose weight, every time you lose a significant amount of weight, a large amount of fat is mobilized from fat stores in your body and is circulated through the bloodstream. While it's being circulated through the bloodstream, it can deposit on arteries and on veins, and can lead to the development of arteriosclerotic cardiovascular disease and other forms of arteriosclerotic disease. And therefore, the best thing to do is to lose weight, go through a period where the fat is going through the bloodstream, go through that period under the supervision of the doctor, to go into this kind of vulnerable period, and then lose the weight and keep it off.
I have one more question for you. Vivian mentioned that if you are going to a trial or facing any kind of discrimination, the idea that is always had of you if you're fat is that if you just removed yourself from the dinner table a little earlier, you wouldn't be fat, you would be more average in size. In other words, that most people assume if you're fat, it's because you're eating too much and you have a romance with food that you can't break away from. You're talking about dieting. I'm under the impression now from the reading I've been doing, from listening to a few people speak, that overeating is not always the cause of being fat. How would you react to that? And if that's the case, would dieting be effective anyways in losing weight?
Well, I would have to say a couple of things. I think one of the questions that you're asking is, do fat people eat more than normal-sized people? Is that correct?
Right.
Okay. I would say that they really probably do eat more. On a day-to-day basis, you may see that fat people eat about the same amount that an average person does. However, they tend to binge more, and they also tend to eat to a feeling of being bloated and stuffed than to a feeling of being pleasantly full. And the day-to-day experience of doing that, even if it's just a little more food than the average person will eat, will put on weight in a constant, steady, accumulative sort of way. And I think you're right. It is not just a matter of telling people to push themselves away from the table. I think that it's a complicated problem, and we now use 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 approaches to people, anywhere from behavioral techniques, psychotherapy, education. We teach people the biochemistry and the physiology of their bodies, of hypoglycemia, of carbohydrate and protein metabolism, insulin, pancreatic function. We teach people exercise. We teach people how to approach exercise. We teach people how to handle stress through meditation, yoga, that sort of thing. And, of course, nutrition therapy, which is vitamins and putting people on a good diet, a diet which not only satisfies their needs,
and not only satisfies the needs of every human being, but which satisfies their personal needs based on their own physiology.
Okay, we're out of time. I want to thank you very much for joining us on the telephone.
You're quite welcome.
Okay, bye-bye now.
All right.
I've been speaking with Dr. Carolyn Michelson. She's the founder of Associates in Medical Nutrition and Weight Control, which is a medically supervised weight control program. A little later in the show, we'll be making available a phone number where you can find out how to reach any of the organizations that we're discussing this afternoon. I'd like to reintroduce my two guests in the studio, Edie Callahan, the president of the Southeastern Pennsylvania chapter of NAFA. That stands for the National Association to Aid Fat Americans, and Natalie Allen, a sociologist who has studied and written about the self-images fat people have of themselves, and she's also done some research into group dieting plans. Our phone lines will be open for your questions and comments in a few minutes. I'd like to ask both of you, Edie, Natalie, if you have had any reactions to what's been being said over the past 20 minutes via telephone, if anything that was said really rang a bell for you, or if there's anything that really you found you disagreed with.
I know Vivian, and she's not a fat person, by the way. She isn't fat, and what people would call fat. She's an average person. I heard this word mentioned many times today, and I wonder what the average person is. If you walk the streets of any city, I wonder how you could pick out the average person. And since we have the doctor has used the word average person, then I know many average persons, average people, who can surely consume a lot of food. And I wonder if there isn't another aspect to being fat besides eating a lot of food. In fact, there has to be. If you see some families and even the children or families who are not like cousins who are not in the same household, the doctors can always blame that on that, you know, that you're in the same house, so you're eating, you know, what mother puts on the table, who are not in the same household but happen to be fat. How is this explained? I don't know about, like I said, about fat people eating more. I imagine there are some fat people, but I don't think that the doctor could say that that is the fat person.
Edie, let me ask you, and if I'm getting too personal, you don't have to ask this. You are fat.
Yes.
And Dr. Michelson said on the telephone that most fat people eat to the point not where they feel like their hunger has been satiated, but they eat beyond that to the point of being bloated.
Yes.
Do you experience that, and people in NAFA feel that way, do you think?
No. I personally can answer that I do not. But, you know, this is very difficult to get. If you say that to people, you know, my family will tell you, see, but they're not here to tell you what I eat and how I eat. And people who know me, who have been out with me or seen me, will say, you know, my goodness, is that all you're going to eat, you know, or something like that. And I can't speak for NAFA or how other NAFans or other fat people eat. I can only speak for myself. But when you try to tell this to people, see, you get laughed at because that is our society. Our society has said you are fat because you eat too much or you eat the wrong things.
I have heard it said about a lot of people, well, they don't eat much when they're out to dinner or when you're over to their house for dinner or they're over for your house to dinner. But when they're home alone, they really eat. But you're just never around to see it.
How do they know this? I mean, they're just taking it because you're fat that's what you do. And it is not true. It is not true. I'm not saying that for all fat people. I'm sure there's some that do that. But it is not true in a lot of cases.
Natalie Allen, of the comments that we were listening to on the telephone, did anything really ring a bell with you?
Yes, one thing I'd like to mention, if there have been studies of medical doctors' attitudes toward fat people, and there have been some studies that have suggested that medical doctors have attitudes more based on informal experiences in the culture rather than formal scientific medical training. Sometimes doctors do not get that much training in nutrition and obesity in a number of medical schools. And in some studies, doctors have considered fat people to be weak-willed, ugly, and awkward, and sometimes to even have more negative self-images about themselves than the fat people in fact have. So I think that one has to really see the fact that doctors are human beings too, and sometimes pick up cultural stereotypes and images in the society that are anti-fat as much as they base some of their views of fat people on actual science and formal medical training. Also, I would reinforce the fact about this choice-non-choice dilemma that it may be true that some people choose to be fat, they want to be fat for whatever kinds of physical, psychological, social reasons, as a rebellion against whatever, they want to eat a lot and they want to be fat. It also seems that with scientific and medical evidence, it's not clear that fatness is necessarily a choice in terms of metabolic factors, in terms of sometimes the fact of equilibrium in the body. I'm not a medical doctor. I wouldn't want to speak too much about this, but that there is a resistance in the body of many people to lose the weight and keep it off. The other thing I'd like to comment on, some of the medical things, just sort of from my own reactions of talking to a number of fat people, is that when you talk about success rate from dieting, you have to start talking about 5 and 10 year success rates. You can't just talk about immediate success rates, or I would even say 1, 2, or 3 years. I think you're talking about lifetime, long-term success rates with regard to dieting that become very important, and we don't have very many studies that are into that now, although we probably, hopefully, will get some more. The other thing is, what do you do in terms of dealing with the weight thing? Maybe some people want to stick to a program or want to stick to, be it group dieting or any other kind of weight losing type of program for the rest of their lives. But maybe some people don't. It may be that what happens when people don't have that kind of thing to hang on to in terms of the regaining of weight, possibly.
You brought up the idea of choice in this, and we'll actually, before I get to this, let me say our phone lines are going to be open now. If you'd like to call with any questions or comments, questions from my two guests in the studio, sociologist Natalie Allen and Edie Callahan, who's the president of the local chapter of the National Association to Aid Fat Americans, you can call now. Our number is 387-6660 and 387-6663. Once again, that's 387-6660 and 387-6663. Getting back to the idea of choice, there seems to be at the root of some of the question of whether to diet or not to diet a question that many people face about many aspects of their lives. And that is, if there's something about yourself that you feel is less than the ideal, is something deviant from the ideal, and you think that the ideal is okay, what do you do? Do you really become energetic in trying to change yourself to more suit that ideal? Or do you try to accept in yourself that which you may perceive even as a flaw and say, well, I am who I am, I will accept this? And it's two conflicting notions that I think many people face in their lives about many different aspects of their lives. Edie, can you comment on that?
I think that's, average for everything. I think I can only speak personally. I think once that I found out that this was me, and I'm very content with myself. I always have been. This is me. I've been diets 7 times to Weight Watchers. Lynn was my neighbor for many years. I went to Dr. Lynn, went through that, almost wound up in the psychiatric hospital. I've been many. Too many to mention, and every one that's been advertised I've had, till I finally found out that this was me and became very content with who I was, and then started making the best of the things that I had to offer to other people. When I found out the act of giving, that's when I became adjusted to myself and accepted who I am. Of course, I didn't have too much of a problem. I think, and I have to give all the credit to my family, I think that's where a lot of people's problems, fat people's problems, and people that have other problems stem from. And when you have parents or brothers and sisters, a husband, like I have a daughter, a son-in-law, friends, cousins, aunts and uncles, who are all loving and giving and surround you with good things, you adjust more readily. I found out, belonging to NAFA, and found out from a lot of the fellows and girls there that life, from the very beginning of their life, from when they were little tykes, Their own families made their problems for them for being fat. Constantly their mothers, you know, you're fat, you're fat, you're fat, and taking things from them or insulting them or saying mean things or not wanting to be seen with them. This type of thing. And that can, then you don't adjust ever, I guess, to what you are.
Natalie, can you speak a little bit on this conflict between wanting to change yourself and wanting to accept yourself?
Well, there's another point of view, I think, also, which is to not only think of changing the self, but to think of changing stereotypes and social images. I think one of the problems in this society is we are very rigid about some of the ideals that we have. I have never, nor do I now, take the position that all people should be fat or eat as much as they want or whatever. I think we have to open up in many areas of life an appreciation of multiple bodily shapes and styles and take them for what they are. And as many people in NAFA have told me, most perceptively, think of fat as a characteristic of a person. Like blue eyes, like red hair. If some people want to try and get the fat off, all the more power to them. If some people have tried and they can't, all the more power to them. If some people don't want to, all the more power to them. And I think we've got to be much more relativistic about the appreciation here. I also don't believe that many fat people want to feel nor need to feel that fatness is a flaw, as sort of, well, I'll compensate in other ways because I know I'm fat and that's a bad thing. I think one of the problems is that we don't have that much research and not many studies on happy, relatively well-adjusted, healthy, very competent fat people. And I can't say that none exist. I've met too many who are that way, and I think we've got an overload in research of assuming that fat people have various kinds of psychological, physical, and social problems, which certainly socially is true in the society which has stigma, but we need to sort of talk about people where you don't assume the flaws at the outset of the research.
Well, we're going to go to the telephones now. We do have some open phone lines. If you'd like to call us with any questions or comments, we're at 387-6660 or 387-6663. I do urge you, though, to not call with any questions about diet plans, because that's not what we're discussing this afternoon. And my two guests who are in the studio to respond to your questions and comments are not authorities by any means on diet plans. So we're not here to discuss that. But otherwise, any questions or comments, give us a call at 387-6660 or 387-6663. Hello, this is Fresh Hair, and you're on the air.
Okay, I would like to make a comment here, and also I have a question. I have, I'm 26 years old. I've been up and down on the scales. I've tried every diet plan from the Atkins diet to 1,000 calorie a day. I also have watched a lot of ads in the newspapers and magazines claiming very wild claims of weight loss, which for me at least, it plays on people's anxieties. I was wondering if there's any possible movement going towards stopping these kinds of claims, which in my opinion, it happens to be very, very big business.
Do either of you know about that?
I only know about the liquid protein, which, you know, that's, I think everybody knows now, but NAFA had, from the very beginning, had gone after that and tried to have that looked into long before DNO came out about it. But as the other one, I know, I have, in fact, I have one of the ads with me that was a full-page ad in one of our daily papers here. And they claim the impossible. And I wonder who can go after them besides the FDA.
Natalie, do you have any information on this?
I have no information, but I would encourage this gentleman and encourage other people, if they think such claims are false, that they try individually or collectively to do something about it. I don't know if that means writing to congressmen, senators, or do something political, mm-hmm. but I really think that if you feel you've tried something that is false, and it really is false, that you should make a fuss about it by talking to somebody in the political arena. I don't quite know, perhaps a consumer's union, a consumer's protection agency, certainly make your concern known.
I'd just like to say I have seen the same thing done in the case of hearing aids. Mm-hmm. If you think back a couple of years, there was a situation where I finally started clamping down on some of these people that were selling mail-order hearing aids. Now the biggest craze seems to be mail-order diet pills. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, listen, thanks very much for calling.
You're quite welcome.
Okay, bye-bye. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Yes, I was just wondering if I could get some feedback from your guest about I've been on a no-carbohydrate or low-carbohydrate diet, and I'll be on it for, you know, they say something like 13 days is as long as you should be on it. And then when I get off of it, I mean, I can gain 2 pounds within 24 hours, you know? And it just seems like, maybe to be more specific, I mean, do other people run into this when they're dieting? That, I mean, it looks like a lifetime project. I'm going to go off of it 2 days and go back on it. And, yeah, you know, that's pretty frustrating.
Edie Kelly?
No, it is. When you're fat, dieting is a lifetime. There has to be something drastically wrong inside that you're not burning up the calories or something. And you, once you go on a diet, you must stay on it for the rest of your life. There is no way that you can begin to eat again. I've heard it said to fat people, they just walk past the buffet table without even picking anything up, and they've gained 10 pounds by the time they get to the end of it.
Yeah. Well, I guess maybe it's just that it's impossible to really do one of these temporary diets. I mean, you can't really look at them as the answer, I suppose, which is what you were saying earlier in your program, that you have to get back to, I guess, analyzing your nutrition and body.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Okay, listen, thanks very much for calling.
Sure.
Okay, bye-bye. If you'd like to call us, we're at 387-6660 or 387-6663. Natalie, you wanted to make a comment?
Yes, just in a general reaction to that last question comment, is that I think a lot of people think of dieting and losing weight as a magic panacea, that their life problems, physically, psychologically, socially, are going to be solved. If I only were thin, I'll get that big job, I'll get the man or woman I want as a marriage partner, that people have a sort of overload the issue of losing weight as a final be-all and end-all. And what happens very, very sadly that I've seen among a number of individuals is the person may lose the weight and even for a little while keep it off. And their life does not become all peaches and cream overnight. So I think that this is another sort of false illusion that some people suffer from in this society.
According to my understanding, NAFA, the National Association to Aid Fat Americans, doesn't really pass judgment on dieting. In other words, I believe their policy is if you want to diet, fine, go ahead and diet. If you don't want to diet, fine, don't diet. However, they do say in one of their pamphlets that I read that they resent groups that try to shame you into dieting. Natalie, you have studied group dieting plans. Have you found that to be true, that in some group diets, the people who register there are embarrassed into wanting to lose weight?
The particular group that I studied did not do that. I had rather positive feelings with people who wanted to lose weight who went to the group, because people really shared their ups and downs, their woes of dieting, what dieting might symbolize in other parts of their lives. However, I have heard and I have read about other groups where people have to wear animal signs around their necks or songs are being sung to them of shame, shame you. And again, you know, I'm very relativistic. I mean, if some people feel that they are going to be helped in losing weight and they want the shame, I would be the last one to say that shame for some people might not work. At the same time, it's very embarrassing and humiliating, and it's very frustrating to some people who've gone to those groups with shame as a strong technique, because they don't want that, and it makes them feel worse and feel more humiliated having to go through that kind of process. But it seems to me, again, it's really what people want to sort of get out of this. Some group dieting for some people is very helpful. People can let off steam, they can make friends, they can find it a sociable occasion, they can express a lot of fears and worries, and sometimes one of my own research projects has suggested that people can get more out of dieting than losing weight, whether or not they lose weight in the groups, in terms of just sort of an emotional venting, expressing fears and worries, and sometimes this seems to help people along the road of life, perhaps more than actual weight losing.
Edie, what about your experiences with group dieting, the experiences that you've had, if you've had any, and that other people who you know through NAFA who have participated in these plans?
Yeah. Any of the girls in my chapter and fellows that I've talked to have all had negative reactions to the group dieting. And I myself, like I said, have been many, many times. And one instance that shied me away was that my neighbor was working for the organization and she was the one that did the weighing in. You know, so things like that, when you go to something that's a group thing. She had only a few pounds to lose and had lost them, and there she was working there. And when you live in a small town, sometimes something like that's not good. Another time I had the experience of I bowled four times a week in four different leagues at one time. And their meeting happened to be on one of my bowling days. And she told me I just had to give up my bowling that day. That was all, you know, and come to this, to the group. So that sort of, you know, turned me off.
Let me ask you, you have said before, and I don't remember whether it was on the air or off the air, that you never wanted to be thin, that you've always been satisfied with your life and with your body. Yes. If that's the case, why have you been to group diet plans about seven
times?
Well,
I was young. I think as I've grown older, when I was 18, I went on a diet, and never at the prodding of family, always at my own, you know. And of course, when you're young and you're 18 to 20 some, you know, and then like anybody else or anything else, you have your moments that you think, oh boy, you know, wouldn't it be nice if I wore size 10 or something, which I would never wear anyway, because you see, I'm big to begin with. But you say that you have these little, you know, moments, and I've had mine. But for many, many years, I haven't given too much thought to dieting.
Okay, we're going to take a couple of more phone calls. Hello, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Yes, this is Edie Callahan's daughter, and I was just calling to confirm everything that my mother's been saying and to say how proud I am of her and back up everything that Nafa says, too. They're just great.
Okay, it's sweet of you to call. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Yes, I've always been underweight. I always felt like I was about 15 or 20 pounds too light, and I was surprised to hear about clinics involved in that. And I was wondering if many people participate in that kind of a thing.
People who are underweight?
Yes.
I really couldn't tell you, and the doctor who is involved with that is not with us in the studio. She joined us on the telephone, so she cannot describe that for you now either.
Okay.
However, after the show, I will be making available all the resources of getting in touch with all the organizations that we've discussed this afternoon.
Thank you
very much. If you're just joining us, we're talking about being fat. I have two guests in the studio with me now. My guest is Edie Callahan, who is the local chapter president of NAFA, that's the National Association to Aid Fat Americans. With us also is sociologist Natalie Allen. She has done a few studies on fat people, both on dieting and on self-perceptions of fat people. We're going to go back to the telephones now and take another phone call. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air. Hello, you're on the air.
Oh, hello there. Teddy, this is Russ Johnson.
Hi.
Are you there?
Yes, go ahead.
I am a clinical psychologist, and in the early 60s, we ran a fat person's clinic. It failed miserably, and we then brought the people into the hospital. I was on the staff of a general hospital, so we had a complete medical backup. We did not succeed in reducing the weight of the people. The sine qua non for entrance was that they had to be over 300 pounds. We worked with adolescents, so we didn't have anyone in the program who was over 20. One of the findings that came out of the study was that we began to suspect that some fat people gain weight by inhaling the vapors of food. We began to pursue this, and unfortunately, the funding for the grant ran out, and the hospital wasn't about to appropriate monies for this, since it was a general medical hospital, and their priority was general medical problems.
That sounds crazy to me, to tell you the truth. I can really tell you, I've hardly ever heard anything as preposterous in my life. Is that really true?
Are you asking me?
Yeah.
Yes. Since then, I have been looking for some sequel to that study. The thing that tipped us off was that we had a batch of people who were over our age limit. They were all cooks. I went to several of the restaurants where they worked, and in one case, I didn't see the person eat anything all day long, and they continued to gain weight. Upon a rather rigorous psychiatric interview, we were fairly certain that what they were telling us was the truth.
Okay. Thanks very much for calling. Why don't you call the station after the program?
All right, I can do that.
Okay, thanks for calling.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. I really think that sounds preposterous, but have you heard anything like that, either of you?
Never.
Oh, Natalie, really?
I have heard wild theories of various sorts of people losing and gaining weight. And I mean, I really can't comment on that particular notion. I know of no research at this time going on with regard to that issue.
Okay. If I find out any more about that, I will certainly pass it on to everybody in the studio and in the audience. We have heard a lot of talk this afternoon about discrimination against fat people, stereotypes that are projected onto fat people. Edie, what are some of these things that you've run into in your own life?
I've never, fortunately, I've been married for 26 years, and I've been a housewife and mother for that long, so I haven't had to go into the job market. And like I say, when I was a young girl, I was forever on diets and getting, not thin, I was never thin, but going down, you know, and up. And I have never personally in the job market had that problem. But socially, it can be very, very frustrating at times. And I, you know, I wonder why. Are fat people, the discrimination, and I'm not talking about in the job market or anything, I'm talking about on the streets. I'm talking about in a restaurant. I'm talking about anywhere you want to go. Who started all this nonsense of making fun and laughing at fat people and in a restaurant watching what they eat and not watching what you're putting in your own mouth? Who started all this? Was it the designers, the dress designers, the slim, you know, let's all look slim together? I don't think we can blame it all on the medical profession. Because, like the doctor said, they're mainly concerned with the medical aspect of it. But socially, when you're on the street every day, when you're outside every day, and you get glances and you get laughed at, and sometimes right directly to your face remarks are made, why? That's always been my concern. I always wondered why. And who made it so that you look funnier than someone else does that's walking down the street? Like I said before, you know, there's a lot of quote, beautiful, unquote, people in this world, but there's very few pretty people in this world. And why is it that a fat person must be subject to going into a restaurant? And I've had, let me just give you an example of an experience I had. My cousin and her husband, my husband and I, went to a buffet dinner. There were three ladies sitting at the next table. Now, sometimes I'm very touchy. I can feel. I get the bad vibes lots of times. I can feel it around me. So the one lady said to the other one this ought to be good. It was a huge buffet. So my cousin and I got up to go to the table. Now, I'm one of these people that don't like my foods mixed together. And I hate everything. I don't even like them touching on the plate. I like everything separate. So when I went up, I just took a little bit of things so that they wouldn't, for that reason, that they all wouldn't be together. When we went back to the table, the three of them were staring at me, and the one said, well, that's a shock, isn't it? Look what's on the plate. So this is the kind of thing that we are subject to, and I often ask, why? Why? I have seen people in restaurants with atrocious manners, terrible at a table, but they're not fat. So nobody seems to notice them, but say it were a fat person at the table with those bad manners, it would be very noticeable.
Well, I'd like to say that I've known some people who were very concerned about their own weight, who are maybe just had a little pot belly. They certainly were not fat, but they had a bit of a paunch and would like to be a little slimmer in profile than they were. And a couple of those people would be the first people to criticize someone who they perceive as overeating or someone who they perceive as being overweight. Mm-hmm. And I've thought sometimes that it was because they were so self-conscious about their own few pounds that they wished they had lost and had trouble keeping off. Mm-hmm. Well, we are almost out of time. I'd like to ask both of you what you think's going to happen in the next few years in this movement that is now starting to help stop discrimination against fat people and to help change the stereotypes people have of fat people. Mm-hmm. Edie?
Well, with NAFA, I'm hoping and praying that NAFA is going to make a place for itself in this world. We've doubled our membership since our last convention and since we were on 60 Minutes, which has been just wonderful. So many people have found out. But I'm hoping that more people will come around and discover that we fat people are just people.
Natalie Allen?
I think there will be increased awareness of the problems, really, of discrimination, and that they will continue to grow and be alive and well.
I want to thank you both for spending the afternoon with us. My guests have been Natalie Allen. She's a sociologist who has studied the self-images fat people have of themselves, and she studied group dieting plans. In Philadelphia, she is an assistant professor of sociology at the Philadelphia College of Textiles and Sciences. Also with me has been Edie Callahan, president of the local chapter of NAFA, the National Association to Aid Fat Americans. I'd also like to thank Dr. Carolyn Michelson and Vivian Mayer for joining us earlier on the telephone. If you'd like to be connected with any of the resources or people we've spoken with this afternoon, give us a call when the show ends at 387-6660 or 387-6661, and we will tell you how to get in touch. Again, that's 387-6660 or 387-6661 or 6663. Okay, you've got your options. That's it for this afternoon's Fresh Air. I'd like to thank you for listening. The associate producer of Fresh Air, Danny Miller, is on vacation. Production assistance today was provided by Joe DiGiuseppe. The technical director this afternoon was Paul Keller. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. I hope you have a very good evening. YFM in Philadelphia, listener-supported public radio.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Susan Stamberg with the Thursday edition of All Things Considered.
Much of what we began in these last 30 months, of course, is not yet finished. I can understand, however, that the president could feel the need to reorient his priorities, to rely more heavily on his personal staff, and to prepare his administration for the challenges of the next 18 months.
The guard has begun to change. Resignations today from Joseph Califano and Michael Blumenthal, the Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, and the Secretary of the Treasury, become the first to fall in the Carter administration. Tonight on All Things Considered, the disciples discipline themselves straight out of office. We'll explore the clash points that brought about these resignations, have a reaction from Capitol Hill, where surprise and criticism mix with some gallows humor. Also tonight, we observe two 10th anniversaries, Neil Armstrong's small step on the moon and Edward Kennedy's slip on Chappaquiddick. That and more this evening on All Things Considered. First, this news from Craig Oliver.
President Carter began rearranging his cabinet today. He accepted the resignations of HEW Secretary Joseph Califano, Treasury Secretary Michael Blumenthal, and Attorney General Griffin Bell. Bell will be replaced by his deputy, Benjamin Civiletti. Bell had said he wanted to leave anyway and return to private law practice. Blumenthal will be replaced by the head of the Federal Reserve Board, G. William Miller. Califano will be replaced by Patricia Harris.